Thank you very much for your very kind introduction, and thanks for the invitation to give the talk here. I really appreciate it, and it's an honor and a pleasure, and I hope it'll be a pleasure for you too. I have to say, before I start, I have to sit. I'm waiting for a new knee, but the old one doesn't quite support me for the duration of my talk. So I'm a little stuck in place. I can't walk and all that. But I hope that's not a problem for the paper. So I want to talk tonight about Groundwork One. That is the first of three sections of Kant's very, very famous little book, Groundwork for the Metaphysics of Morals. And in the first section of that book, Kant claims to identify the supreme principle of morality. After, and I'm sure you've read it and heard it yourself, after famous discussions of the idea of a good will, acting from duty, respect, and other related topics, Kant concludes that the highest moral principle is the following. I quote, "I ought never to proceed except in such a way that I could also will that my maxim should become a universal law," the famous principle. Kant claims that this is the principle that implicitly governs our ordinary moral practices and beliefs. It's the supreme principle in that it is a meta-principle by way of which you can derive substantive Kantian moral principles such as don't lie, help others in need, and so on. Because Kant draws on ordinary moral beliefs that are still widely shared, not unanimously shared, but still widely enough shared, and because his conclusion articulates a paradigmatic position in moral philosophy, Groundwork One has become one of the most renowned texts in the history of philosophy. The structure of Kant's argument in Groundwork One, that is, the argument towards the identification of the supreme principle, has been the subject of much debate, however. And there are three serious difficulties, really serious difficulties, that stand out in the literature, and they all concern the most important steps of Kant's argument. So sometimes you can think, why is this guy so famous if there are so many problems with his arguments? But so the first difficulty is that Kant presents his argument as consisting of three propositions followed by a concluding inference to the supreme principle. But Kant doesn't make explicit what he takes the first proposition to be. He labels only the second and the third as such. In the literature of the past few decades, at least a dozen candidate first propositions have been put forward. So that's only from the past 20 years, at least a dozen different principles. So that's the first problem. The second problem is that Kant claims that the third proposition follows from the first two, but it is widely regarded as unclear how it is supposed to follow, or if it follows at all. And I will explain why and what the problem is as we go along. And the third problem is that Kant's final step, the inference, the concluding inference to the identity of the supreme moral principle, is often said to include a jump over a gap rather than a careful step, rather than being a careful step that follows from the preceding argument. As a result of these three difficulties, Kant's reasoning towards the supreme moral principle seems more like a series of assertions and fragmentary arguments than a single argumentative chain. Now, in this paper, I argue that Kant's views on philosophical method shed new light on the structure and the direction of the argument in Groundwork One. It's gone unnoticed, I think, as far as I know, that this argument consists of a chain of regressive inferences. I first explained the current positions in the literature on Groundwork One. I will be very brief about that. And then I turn to Kant's views on method, and using his description of the so-called analytic method, I reconstruct the argument of Groundwork One as a regressive chain. and I argue that this reconstruction suggests solutions to the three main difficulties diagnosed in the literature, although, as I will explain, several unclarities remain. So that's the schedule for the talk. There is a handout. I hope everybody has a handout because that includes the overview of the argument. Excuse me? But there are some handouts.
Yes.
Okay, so the handout was meant to be kind of handy to give you the full argument on one page. So if you have a way of sharing the handout with your neighbor or something, it may come in handy. But I will say everything you need to know anyway. So I get to section two, the main positions in the literature. When discussing the method and structure of the groundwork in the book's preface, Kant announces that he will begin by using an analytic approach, but he doesn't say what that means. It's often noted that in his Prolegomena, Kant uses the so-called analytic method, but most authors deny that that is the method Kant uses in Groundwork 1. And the reason is that in the Prolegomena, Kant starts from syntactic judgment a priori, such as the causality principle, and then he argues through regressive inferences that these synthetic judgments a priori must have their source in our cognitive faculties. But in Groundwork 1, he doesn't start from synthetic judgments a priori. And authors take that to mean that he doesn't use the analytic method. Instead, they take the analytic approach to consist in conceptual analysis, where they take conceptual analysis either in a narrow sense of, you know, what we all think of as conceptual analysis of the concept, in this case, of a good will, or they take it in a broader and less technical methodological sense of an analysis of the ordinary conception of morality. Now, in light of time constraints, I will just give you this very broad characterization of the main positions in the literature, and I will focus on developing my alternative reconstruction and challenge this the consensus and argue that Kant does use the analytic method in Groundwork 1. So I turn to his views on method. There is at least one chair, two chairs still available in front here, for people who want to sit. Okay, section three. So Kant's views on method and the structure of regressive arguments. In his lectures on logic, Kant distinguishes two philosophical methods, that is, two ways in which one can connect the steps in a chain of reasoning. The analytic and the synthetic method. The synthetic method involves reasoning from premises to conclusions, from grounds to their consequences, from conditions to that which is conditioned, and so on. Here the reasoning moves downstream from what is most fundamental to that which flows from it or is based on it. Kant calls this a progressive direction, and you can sort of see, you know, you have your premises, and then you progress to the conclusion, and you keep doing that downstream. The analytic method involves reasoning in the other direction. Here, you begin with something given, or a proposition assumed to be true, and you reason backward to identify that which must underlie it as its ground or condition or premises. So you do this via an inference to the only possible ground or premises or conditions. Kant comments that it would have been more fitting to call the analytic method regressive rather than analytic, but he keeps using both terms, regressive and analytic. And in much of the literature, I think what people call, not Kant, but what people call the transcendental method is very closely related to this. A simple non-philosophical example helps to explain the analytic method of reasoning. Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock Holmes happens upon the scene of a murder on a barge in the middle of a large lake. There is a victim lying face down, and Sherlock sees a small but deep round wound in her back. He also sees three weapons lying on the barge, namely an axe, a bow, and a club. He reasons as follows. The small, deep, round wound can have been produced neither by the axe nor by the club, but only by an arrow shot with the bow. Therefore, the weapon was a bow. Sherlock's reasoning, and Sherlock will proceed from there to, you know, try to find who must have been the murderer in making further inferences of that kind, using the regressive logic of backward inferences. He reasons from the observed consequence, the dead victim, to its cause by ruling out all candidate causes except one. So as I just said, his next question will be, of course, who used the weapon? And he'll try to move upstream until he gets to the murderer. This example also draws our attention to an important feature of regressive reasoning, and some aspiring Sherlocks in the room will have figured that out already. It yields a valid argument only if the set of candidate possibilities is complete. And in the case of our example, Sherlock had an off day because his inference is valid only if he also establishes that the murderer can have used no other weapon than the three lying on the barge. In the example, he fails to do this. He fails to rule out, for example, that the murderer used a gun or a pointy stick and tossed the weapon into the lake or left with it on another boat, right? There are further possibilities. But if your set is complete, then you can make these kinds of inferences. So the regressive reasoning basically goes as follows. Concerning a given point of departure, you identify what explains or grounds or underlies it as its condition or premises. You identify the set of candidate answers. You rule out all candidates except and you find the only possible answer. And then you repeat the procedure at the next step. At least this is how Kant presents and applies the analytic method. Kant is not talking about abductive inferences to the best or most plausible explanation. Kant is talking about inferences to the only possible one. Now, in some cases, only one step suffices, but in other cases, you need to repeat the procedure many times. And we'll see that Kant repeats the procedure several times until he reaches the supreme principle of morality. And so actually my best example of how this procedure works is Kant's argument as I reconstruct it and as you see it on the handout. Importantly, nothing in Kant's description of the analytic method as such implies that it must start from synthetic judgments a priori. Whether you use the analytic method depends on the way in which you connect the steps of your reasoning. Sherlock starts with murders. Kant starts with synthetic judgment a priori in the Prolegomena and with common moral beliefs in the groundwork, because there he seeks to determine the supreme principle of morality. He just has a different question than the question he wants to answer in the Prolegomena. So Kant seeks to determine the supreme principle of morality, and in the groundwork he starts with what he takes to be the ordinary conception of morality and ordinary moral judgments, what he calls common moral cognition, or what he calls the common idea of moral duty and moral laws. And he reasons backwards from there to identify the supreme principle that implicitly governs these ordinary moral beliefs and judgments. Finally, Kant nowhere defines the analytic method in terms of conceptual analysis. Conceptual analysis can be useful, of course, in any type of argument, and Kant makes use of it in Groundwork 1. But what characterizes the analytic method as such is the regressive structure of the argumentation. So this much about the method. as such. And now let's turn to Groundwork One and see how Kant applies it. And let me begin with a brief overview of the main steps so you see, you know, what the four steps are and what Kant wants to do. So as I said, his aim is to identify the supreme principle of morality, that is to identify that by virtue of which that which is morally good is morally good. That's what Kant means by a principle. Now, something cannot be the supreme principle of moral goodness if it is merely contingently morally good, that is, if its goodness depends on something else. And that is why, I think, Kant begins by considering what is absolutely good, or in the terminology of the first sentence of the groundwork, what is good without restriction. And his answer is a good will. He gives an argument for that. And then he subsequently zeroes in several steps, on that by virtue of which a good will is good without restriction, since that must ultimately be the supreme principle of morality. So in rough and abbreviated form, very rough and very abbreviated, the details will come, Kant's argument runs as follows, and this is just the shortest overview of the argument. Kant asks, what is good without restriction, right? Because he wants to find the good-making feature of what's morally good. Kant argues that can be nothing except a good will, which, in the human case, is a will that's determined to act from duty. By virtue of what is a will that determined to act from duty good without restriction? The answer can only be by virtue of the maxim that determines the will. Which maxim determines a will that's determined to act from duty? This can only be, and that's Kant's argument, the maxim to obey the moral law from respect for the law. What law can that be? This can only be the following, and then we get to the categorical imperative that I quoted at the beginning of my paper. So that's Kant's concluding inference to the supreme moral principle. And so what you see is that every answer that he gives leads to a new question that takes the argument further towards the underlying supreme principle. Okay? That's the overview, and now I'll give you all the details. It's section four, but that's basically the bulk of the paper. So, and it's subdivided in terms of the propositions that Kant argues for, and so I start with the first proposition. Kant begins Groundwork One with that famous statement that you all know, there's nothing conceivable anywhere in the world, or indeed even outside it, that could be good, that could be considered good without restriction, except a good will, end quote. Now, this is not an axiom. Kant next presents the argument in its support. And he does that by considering a set of possible candidates for unrestricted goodness and ruling out all except one. The set includes things widely considered by other philosophers to be good, or even absolutely good, under the rubrics of gifts of nature, gifts of fortune, self-regulatory capacities, and finally, a good will. And among the gifts of nature, Kant counts mental talents, such as understanding, wit, judgment, and psychological traits, including courage, resolve, and persistence, insofar as they are qualities of a person's natural temperament rather than moral character. And among the gifts of fortune, he counts power, riches, honor, health, and everything else that contributes to well-being and contentment under the title of happiness. He further mentions regulatory capacities that are often associated with moral goodness, such as self-control, cool deliberation, moderation in affects and passion, and so on. And then Kant argues that each of these, quote, can become extremely evil and harmful if the will that is to make of them is not good, end quote. That is to say, they're good only on condition that a good will controls and corrects their influence. So they're not absolutely good, not good without restriction. So he concludes that all these candidates for absolute goodness are good only on the condition that they're under the control of a good will. That's the argument there. Now, that those first few paragraphs suggest that only a good will is absolutely good, but it doesn't yet suffice to prove it. For if the goodness of a good will were itself in turn dependent on something else, a condition beyond the willing itself, then the good will would not be good without restriction. And that's, I think, why Kant next considers whether a good will is good by virtue of its morally good willing as such, or by virtue of realizing its ends. In the second case, the goodness of the good will would be merely conditional. And appealing to common moral beliefs, Kant then asserts that if, due to unfortunate circumstances, a good-willed agent fails to achieve its ends, despite his strongest efforts, then that does not diminish the goodness of the good will. So he assumes we agree with him on that. And therefore, he concludes that a good will is good, quote, not because of what it affects or accomplishes, because the goodness doesn't depend on the effect, not because of its fitness to attain some intended end, but only by its willing, that is, in itself. And together, these considerations support the claim that Kant starts the section with: nothing except a good will can be considered good without restriction. Note that Kant doesn't support the first sentence in these paragraphs by an exercise in conceptual analysis. Kant doesn't even explain what he means by a will or by good. He just uses the terms, and in the second section he gives an explanation of what he means by will. But if you think his argument runs through conceptual analysis, I mean, you would think he would start with these notions, but he doesn't. Now, for the regressive argument to work, the set of candidates for absolute goodness must be complete, and Kant evidently believes that it is, but he doesn't explicitly argue that point. He likely believed that his open-ended formulations would capture all candidates. After all, in addition to the goodwill, his argument applies to all valuable mental talents, understanding, wit, judgment, and, quote, whatever else the talents of the mind may be called, right? All good mental talents, all natural temperaments, and all self-regulatory capacities, and it applies to everything that contributes to happiness in the broadest sense. So it's a wide net. But it would have been better and, I think, helpful for understanding his argument if he had explained why or that there are no other suitable candidates. He doesn't, with so many words, rule that out. But he obviously believes that he has ruled them out. So having supported the statement of the first sentence of Groundwork 1, Kant next considers a possible objection based on the idea that nature is a purposive whole. And this is the infamous, rather infamous discussion of natural teleology in Groundwork 1. And it is usually read as an interlude or a digression that doesn't quite fit in the rest of the argument. But I think the passage is as much an integral part of the argument as any consideration of objections is, even if we current readers no longer feel the force of the worry that Kant is dealing with there. Like many of his contemporaries, Kant defended a teleological conception of nature, according to which every predisposition of an organism has some good purpose. Humans have practical reason, that is, the capacity to let reason determine their will. But if, as Kant just argued, a good will has absolute value, irrespective of any considerations of usefulness, doesn't that run counter to the idea that practical reason serves a purpose? That's the worry. And in response to this worry or suspicion, as Kant calls it, he argues that the purpose of reason should not be understood to lie in making us happy, since practical reason is a very unreliable means towards happiness. So its real purpose must be a different one, namely to bring about a will that's genuinely good, and this, Kant maintains, puts the worry to rest. So he's given the argument for the first sentence, then he's dealt with an objection. Now is the time to ask ourselves, okay, before Kant starts preparing the argument for the second proposition, let's ask what the unlabeled first proposition is likely to be. I said at the beginning, Kant doesn't label the first. What is it? Now, in light of the reconstruction of Kant's argument thus far, the first sentence of Groundwork 1 is the obvious candidate. It's literally the first proposition of the section. It's introduced with much emphasis, and most importantly, it is the claim that Kant defends before he turns to his argument with the second proposition. So, that would be my guess. I return to the question of the identity of the first proposition below because most commentators assert that it cannot be the first proposition, but they do that for reasons having to do with the interpretation of the third proposition, the one that supposedly follows from the first and the second. But at this point, right, just looking at what I've discussed so far, the likely candidate for first proposition simply is that famous statement. The second proposition. So having established that the only thing that's conceivably absolutely good is a good will, Kant must next examine, that's the regressive step, by virtue of what the good will is morally good, if he is to move closer to the supreme principle of morality. And to do that, he announces he will focus on the notion of duty. Now, purely rational beings, such as God, according to Kant, purely rational beings have no countervailing incentives to do anything other than what's rationally and morally right. So their will is necessarily good. But for rational beings whose will is not necessarily good, for example, because they're tempted by desires, sensuous desires, such as humans, for those beings, morality is a matter of duty. You ought to follow a certain principle. In their case, a good will is a will that's determined to act from duty. Kant explains that shifting the notion of duty, that is, not shifting away from the notion of a good will, but discussing the good will in the case of finite rational beings, that will enable him to make the good-making quality of the goodwill stand out through contrast, right? So he prepares the second proposition by saying, okay, I'm not going to talk about goodwill in general. I'm going to talk about the goodwill of finite rational beings, which is the will that's determined to act from duty. Now, to determine by virtue of what a will that's determined to act from duty is morally good, Kant contrasts acting from duty with acting from inclination. And he considers two possibilities, either the moral worth of an action is done from duty lies in the purpose of the action, or it lies in the principle or maxim that determines the will. And to determine which of these two answers is the correct one, he runs a thought experiment. And what he does is he considers a series of actions that are in accord with duty, that is, actions that are in outward conformity with what duty demands. And then he keeps the description of the action and its purpose stable, but he varies the underlying maxim of the agent in the example, such that the action is performed from inclination in one case and from duty in the other. For example, and I'm sure you know these scenarios, one scenario involves preserving one's life. Kant contrasts first preserving your life from an inclination to stay alive with, in the second case, preserving your life from duty without any desire to live. Another scenario involves beneficence. There he contrasts being beneficent because one finds pleasure in spreading joy, and he contrasts that is from inclination, and he contrasts that with beneficence from duty without any inclination to it. And then you have to imagine these scenarios, right? Two examples I gave you, and then in each case the action is the same, but the motive of the agent varies. And then Kant reasons as follows. If the moral goodness of acting from duty were to lie in the purpose of the action, then our moral evaluation would be the same in both variations of these scenarios, right? Because the purpose of the action is the same. It's only the reason why the agent does it that's different. So appealing to common moral judgments, Kant says that's not what we find. Rather, we find that our moral evaluation varies depending on which action principle we attribute to the agent. That is, it varies depending on whether the agent acts from duty or from inclination. We attribute moral worth only to the actions done from duty and not to those done from inclination. Actions done from inclination may be amiable. I mean, they're in accord with duty. Qua actions, there's nothing wrong with them. They deserve encouragement, Kant says, if they're in accord with duty. But we judge that they have no, quote, true moral value because their maxim, quote, lacks moral quality. Thus, an action done from duty, and this is Kant's conclusion, an action done from duty has moral worth not by virtue of its purpose, but by virtue of some yet to be identified quality of its maxim, the maxim on which it's done. And Kant concludes then with a regressive inference that the moral worth of actions done from duty can, quote, lie nowhere else but in the principle or maxim of the will. And this yields the second proposition on the handout. Quote, an action from duty has its moral worth not in the purpose that is to be attained by it, but in the maxim according to which it is resolved upon, and thus it does not depend on the actuality of the object of the action, but merely on the principle of willing, according to which, regardless of any object of the faculty of desire, the action is done. That's the second proposition, and it's supported by the argument I just gave you, the thought experiment. So then we get to the third proposition, and the next regressive move after the second proposition and prompted by the second proposition is to ask which maxim determines an action from duty, right? Kant has just concluded that an action from duty has its moral worth not in the purpose but in the maxim. Then the question is, okay, what about that maxim is it that gives it a moral worth? So that's the next question. And the only possible answer, Kant will argue, is the maxim to obey a yet-to-be-identified law, even to the detriment of all my inclinations. So the maxim to obey the moral law, whatever it is, he still needs to find out, even against all my inclinations. That's the answer. Now, since no inclination can possibly motivate the adoption of that maxim, someone acting from duty must have adopted it on the basis of the recognition that one ought to adopt this law, that is, from respect for the law. And that is captured by the so-called third proposition, which Kant introduces before he argues for it. And the third proposition reads, duty is the necessity of an action from respect for the law. But the way Kant introduces this third proposition is rather confusing, and it has indeed led to serious confusion in the literature, especially not just because it is introduced so kind of bluntly and without explanation, and the explanation comes only later, and I will also give you more explanation, but also because Kant immediately says that this third proposition is an inference that follows from the first two propositions. And it is generally considered entirely unclear how, or even that, or certainly that, it is supposed to follow. And you can easily see why. I mean, it does indeed look very weird. In abbreviated form, you would get the following argument. Premise one, that only a good will is absolutely good. Premise two, the moral worth of an action from duty depends on the principle of the will. And then the conclusion would have to be duty is the necessity of an action from respect for the law. I mean, that's not an argument. So it's very clear why people think there is a problem here. And the difficulty is, and this is the difficulty that prompts most authors who contend that Kant's first famous, that his first proposition can't really be the first famous sentence of Groundwork One, right? Because people think, well, if you take the first proposition to be the first statement of the groundwork section one, then the argument doesn't follow. So therefore, that unlabeled first proposition can't be that first statement. That's basically how people reason, understandably. And to solve it, many look for an alternative first proposition that concerns acting from duty and or acting from respect for the law, such that you can make the third proposition follow. And of course, because Kant doesn't label the first proposition, there's ample room for creativity here. And a recent overview from 2022 includes 11 proposals to which the author then adds his own as a 12th. Another common strategy in the literature is to weaken the sense in which the third proposition is supposed to follow from the first and the second. But if you do that, if you weaken the sense of follow, then you basically turn the three proposition in three loose pieces, loosely related claims, rather than a chain of reasoning that leads directly to the supreme principle of morality. So it has some costs to take that weakening strategy. Now, I would like to propose that if we read Kant's argument as a regressive argument, the difficulty of how the third proposition follows disappears, and that also simultaneously removes the obstacle that stood in the way of taking the first sentence of the section as being the first proposition. So how does it follow if we read the argument as an argument that follows the analytic method? Well, if Kant begins by arguing that the only thing that's conceivably absolutely good is a good will, and that was the first proposition, and then he further explains that in the case of humans, a good will is a will that's determined to act from duty, and that the moral worth of acting from duty lies not in the purpose or effect of the action, but in the maxim that determines the will, then it follows, as a regressive inference, that this maxim can only be the maxim to act from duty, and that this maxim can be adopted only because one recognizes that one ought to comply with the moral principle, whatever it is. And that's exactly the content of the third proposition. So this is why the handout is important, because I can tell you this, but it is easy if you can reread it and see it in print rather than only hear it. Kant now uses the terminology of acting from respect for this law to refer to the ground that motivates acting agents who act from duty. Respect, he clarifies, is the consciousness of the subordination of my will to a law without mediation of influences, of other influences on my sense, end quote. So respect for a law is the consciousness that you ought to obey it, that your will is subordinate to the law. Therefore, the answer to the question that was prompted by the second proposition, that is, which maxim determines the will that acts from duty, is this. It's the maxim to comply with the moral law, from respect for this law. That is, you have to, colloquially, you got to do the right thing because it's right. Kant formulates this as follows, with an explicit regressive inference, that is, he formulates the answer as follows, quote, nothing is left over that can, nothing is left over, right? Again, the argument by elimination, nothing is left over that can determine the will in the case of an action from duty, other than objectively the law and subjectively pure respect for this practical law. Hence, the maxim of complying with such a law, even to the detriment of all my inclinations. Thus, Kant has now established that a good will is morally good by virtue of its commitment to comply with the yet-to-be-identified moral law from respect for this law rather than from inclination. Here is how he puts it, again with a backward inference. Nothing other than the representation of the law in itself, insofar as it is the determining ground of the will, can therefore constitute the preeminent good that we call moral. So Kant has traced moral goodness back to acting on the maxim to comply with the not yet identified law from respect for this law. And that prompts the final regressive question, the last step, which law? Right, and so we had a question, what is good without restriction? The answer was a good will. Then that was, Kant shifted to the notion of acting from duty. Then he asked, by virtue of what is an action from duty good without restriction? He had an answer in terms of maxims. And the next question was, what maxim determines the will that acts from duty? And the answer was in terms of respect for the law. And that prompts the question, which law? Right? You see him reasoning to, zooming in on the supreme principle. So we get the concluding inference to the supreme principle. Kant formulates this question, which law, as follows. But what law can that be, the representation of which, even without regard for the effect expected from it, must determine the will for it to be called good, absolutely and without restriction? So thus far, Kant has already reached the intermediate conclusion that whoever acts from duty acts from respect for the law, not because there's something in it for them, but because it's right, and that this respect concerns not the matter of the action, that is not its intended effect. If we know this much, what can we infer about the content of this law? Now, I'm trying to reconstruct Kant's reasoning here, and I'll try to explain what I think Kant's reasoning is with the help of his example of the moral prohibition against lying. And you know, Kant defends the moral prohibition against lying. Now, if someone refrains from lying from duty rather than, say, out of fear of getting caught, so if someone refrains from lying from duty, what must be their implicit principle? Why are they doing it? And on what principle? Now, in addition to its matter, the prohibition, the matter of, you know, no lies, the prohibition against lying has a certain form, as Kant calls it, namely the form of a universal law. It claims to be universally valid for all finite rational agents. Since someone who obeys the prohibition from duty doesn't do so from an inclination towards its matter, as per the argument for the second proposition, they must do so because it has a certain form, Kant infers, and it has the form of a universal law. Similarly, in the case of the moral requirement to help others in need, since someone who obeys this requirement from duty, so someone who helps others in need from duty, that doesn't act on the basis of an inclination to help others, they must be obeying it on the grounds that it has the form of a universal law. It's the only alternative. Mutatis mutandis, the same is true in all other cases of acting from duty. And from this, Kant then infers that agents acting from duty act on the principle to act in such a way that their actions are in conformity with universal law. And this then must be the supreme principle of morality. Kant articulates this conclusion, this concluding inference in the typical fashion again, as in all the other ones, not this but that. And he says, since I've robbed the will of all impulses that could arise for it from following some particular law, nothing remains. So he's robbed the will of all impulses in the sense that he has shown that no such impulses can determine the will that's determined to act from duty, right? A will that's determined to act from duty doesn't act from some impulse or inclination. Okay, so I start again. Since I've robbed the will of all impulses that could arise for it from following some particular law, nothing remains but the conformity of actions with universal law, which alone ought to serve the will as its principle. That is, and I underlined that is on the handout, I think, because it's important for reasons I will mention. That is, I ought never to proceed except in such a way that I could also will that my maxim should become a universal law. This sentence states the main result of groundwork one. Kant's way of formulating it has caused significant puzzlement, however, since the two sentence parts separated by that is don't seem to say the exact same thing. And that's the third difficulty widely associated with Kant's argument in groundwork one. Some authors have argued, for example, that Kant moves from a descriptive claim to a prescriptive claim. Henry Allison has argued that, and that he fails to argue that it has prescriptive force, right? Kant ends with an ought. Where does the ought come from? Some people have asked. There are other differences between the two sentence parts on either side of that is. First, Kant speaks of actions, then of maxims. First, he speaks of conformity of actions with universal law, and then of also being able to will that my maxim should become a universal law. So the gap between these two sentence parts seems pretty wide, right? There are shifts going on there. Now, one thing is certain, that is that Kant is not sufficiently precise. That's hard to quarrel with. But the gap is not nearly as wide as it seems, and there are bridges. First, regarding Kant's alleged move from description to prescription, there really is no gap. There is an ought, soll, in German, on both sides of that is. So we have prescription on both sides. And Allison, for some reason unknown to me, translates the first soll as could, and then you get this problem. But many people think there is this problem. I don't think it is there. There's soll on both sides. Furthermore, when Kant speaks of morally good actions, in the first sentence part, he must be referring to actions done on maxims. It's clear from the very beginning of the groundwork, and repeated several times, that morally good actions are non-accidentally good. You ought to adopt good action principles, maxims, so as to make your actions reliably morally good. Thus, there is a bridge from actions to maxims, that is, actions in the first part before that is, and maxims in the second part, the formulation of the principle, the categorical imperative. Accordingly, Kant also discusses his example of false promising that follows this statement in terms of both the action, the lie, and the underlying maxim, explicitly conceiving of the action as done on a maxim that fails to meet the criterion articulated by the supreme principle of morality. So there clearly is a bridge from action to maxim. Kant understands actions in the first part as done on maxims. The bridge from actions to maxims also helps to make sense of Kant's move from the principle that one ought to conform one's actions to universal law to the principle that I ought to be able also to will that my maxims become universal laws. The second formulation is an explication of how to apply the supreme principle. Kant first states the principle, what ought to serve the will as its principle is the conformity of actions with universal law. That is to say, as a matter of principle, I ought to ensure that my actions, understood as performed on maxims, are in conformity with universal law. But how do I find out whether a particular action on a particular maxim meets this criterion? And Kant suggests by asking whether I can also will that the relevant maxim become a universal law. Because if it is impossible for me to will the maxim and also will that it become a universal law, that reveals that the maxim under consideration does not conform to universal law. And in that case, the action on this maxim fails the test. Although Kant's articulation of the supreme principle therefore need not be seen as including a jump over a gap, I don't mean to imply that the formulation of it is unproblematic. As the history of Kant reception attests, the principle can be interpreted in very many different ways. For example, should I ask myself whether I can will that I and all others act on the maxim? Then also serves to combine two sets of agents. Or should I ask whether I can will the ends incorporated in my maxim and also will that this maxim become a universal law? Then also connects two different possible objects of the will. Or should I ask whether I can will my maxim and also simultaneously will that my maxim become a universal law? Then also refers to the simultaneous compossibility of two volitions, as I have argued, the drawing on the fact that Kant uses simultaneously in very many of the other formulations of the principle. Kant's false promising example does not help to disambiguate these matters, but I won't discuss these ambiguities in any further detail, because my aim here in this paper is limited to reconstructing the steps of Kant's argument. And so I just want to mention that there are ambiguities in the in his conclusion, but I'll just leave it at that. Finally, what about the complaint that Kant fails to argue that the principle has prescriptive force? Once we consider the aim and the regressive structure of his argument, I think it becomes clear why such an argument is unnecessary. Kant's aim is to identify the supreme moral principle. He presupposes morality as a social practice with shared moral beliefs. Given this presupposition, once he has identified the supreme principle, he can immediately present it as the principle that I ought to follow. A helpful analogy from the Prolegomena explains this point further, I think. Kant writes there that his philosophical enterprise is, quote, very closely related, end quote, to that of finding grammatical rules. Grammatical rules govern linguistic practices, even if native speakers of the language may be unable to articulate them explicitly. When grammarians identify the grammatical rules of a language, then they do not also need to argue separately that these rules have prescriptive force. That's presupposed with the practice, right? The linguistic practice. By analogy, when Kant identifies the supreme principle that governs ordinary morality, he doesn't need to argue separately that it has prescriptive force. At least not in Groundwork 1, where he presupposes moral practice and moral beliefs. There are many deeper philosophical issues that need to be addressed concerning the source and the validity of this principle, and Kant is very well aware of them, and he does turn to them in Groundwork 2 and Groundwork 3. In Groundwork One, his aim is limited to identifying the principle, drawing on ordinary moral beliefs. In Groundwork Two, he will discuss its deeper source in pure practical reason and its normative validity in Groundwork Three. So those matters are the subject of the next two sections. So I get to my conclusion. So I've argued that Kant zeroes in on the supreme moral principle via four regressive inferences while presupposing and making use of ordinary moral beliefs. On my reconstruction, the three most notorious difficulties associated with Groundwork One can be solved, or perhaps they don't even arise. Actually, I think they don't arise. The unlabeled first proposition is the famous first section, for the first sentence of the section. The third proposition follows from the first two via a regressive inference, and Kant's concluding inference to the supreme principle of morality does not contain an unbridgeable gap, although the wording of it contains unclarities. Now, if my reading is plausible, I think the next step, of course, would be to examine in more detail whether each of Kant's steps is compelling. And I think it would be worthwhile to discuss the strengths and weaknesses of the analytic method as such and as a method to be used in moral theory. My aim here was much more limited than that. My aim here was just to reconstruct the steps of the argument in a new way. So I thank you for your attention.